Still rocking after all these years.
This is the story of my rock and roll butler.
This is it, the show that started it all. Often imitated, but never equal. From San Francisco, USA, online since 2004, is the one and only Rock and Roll Geek Show. With the original Rock and Roll Geek, Michael Butler.
Welcome to the Rock and Roll Geek Show. My name's Michael Butler. Thanks a lot for joining me. I really appreciate it. Today is Wednesday, April 29th, 2020, and it is 5:42 when I'm doing this show open. This morning at 8 a.m., I had a conversation with Uncle Ted, Ted Nugent, the Motor City Madman, the Whackmaster, Reverend Atrocious Theodosius, and many other names. This in the background is Tad playing bass, six-string bass solo, Sunrise, off a new record, Music Made Me Do It. Say what you want about Ted Nugent. You might not like his politics, but the guy marches to the beat of his own drummer, and he means everything he says, and he does not give two shits about what people think about him if they're critics. And to me, there's not much more rock and roll than that, friends. And the guy is a fucking monster guitar player. Monster. Ask any great guitar player how Ted Nugent is on guitar. They will tell you. The guy does not get the credit on the guitar that he deserves. He's a ripping guitar player. And the tone for fucking days. Well, I've interviewed Ted Nugent before. I interviewed him backstage when he played San Francisco. Interviewed him on the tour bus when he played at the Fillmore in San Francisco, and never had him on the phone to do an hour on the Rock and Roll Geek Show. I've interviewed him for like 15 minutes. So for him to come on this crappy little podcast, I was stoked beyond belief, if I can use a surfer term, stoked. I'm sorry I did not get all of your questions in. I got some of them. I only had an hour. And when you ask Ted a question, you get a long answer. Ted likes to talk. So I tried to keep the interruptions as to a minimum as I could. We talked a little bit about hunting. A lot about rock and roll. Nothing about the Corova. I wanted to ask him some things. I had a lot of things I wanted to talk about. I could have talked to Ted Nugent for 8 hours. No problem. I can ask him. I can talk to him for a long time because he's my guy in the 70s. It was Ted Nugent, Aerosmith, and Cheap Trick. Those were the three main bands for me before I discovered the Ramones and all that. UFO, I love all those. But Ted Nugent, Aerosmith, and Cheap Trick, those were my bands when I was growing up. So, thank you, Ted Nugent, for coming on. I hope you enjoy this interview. It goes about an hour long. I was nervous when I started, but man, the guy is so down to earth and extremely nice to me. So, hope you enjoy it. Thank you, everybody who donated to the Rock and Roll Geek Show. I will do a show this weekend, and I will thank you all individually, but I'll single some people out. First of all, thank you to Dave Slusher for initiating the $100 bidet donation segment. If you donate $100, he will send you a bidet and possibly a t-shirt as well. So thank you to the following people for sending the $100. Anonymous, Dan Gerowan, Rodney Cross, Brian Springer, John Morgan, Chris Capel, the rock and roll copywriter, Joe Pollack, my bodyguard, Benjamin Muller, Rodney Cross, Ralph Miller, friend of the show and friend of mine, J.P. Shipherd, Adam Bruchet, my boy Jonathan Travers, John Morgan again. Thank you to everybody who donated the $100. You have a bidet, a 3D printed bidet coming to you from Dave Slusher. And thank you, Dave Slusher, for initiating that. And thank you to the anonymous donor for the money for the Rodecaster Pro and the Mac Mini. Hope you enjoy it. We'll let this song finish and we'll go right into the Ted Nugent interview. Thank you, friends. I'll talk to you after the interview is over.
Michael, Ted Nugent calling.
Hi, Ted Nugent. Uncle Ted, how you doing?
I'm doing so good it's stupid, despite this fucked up world around us. How about you, son?
I'm pretty good. I interviewed...
Yeah, I'm actually hanging on with miracle ear hearing aid in so I can cherish every syllable you utter. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. I talked to you in San Francisco when you played at this place called The Independent. I interviewed you backstage with me and...
Sure, we were raising hell that day. I remember it was a firestorm of piss and vinegar and energy, and I'm more than happy to share that continuing saga with you, Michael. You deserve me because you are the rock and roll geek.
That's right. Yeah, it's such an honor to have you on. I am a huge fan. I go way back to Papa's Will. I saw you open for Robin Trower in the Jacksonville Coliseum many, many years ago.
Awesome, awesome. How about this, Michael? You're reminiscing and celebrating some of the earlier days. I think I was just a teenager. But how about my bandmates? How about the unbelievable world-class virtuosity of every one of my band members going back to a little before your time, 1958, to Detroit, the Royal High Boys. But what you witnessed, especially Papa's Will, first of all, if they have a Scream Czar category, or do I not with that? Am I not number one in the Scream department?
That's great. That's the best part, man.
I think he was like, You
swallowed the microphone.
The phone can't even.
Swallowed the microphone.
The telephone can't even grasp the dynamic of my primordial scream. But really, examine it, Michael. I mean, come on. Who doesn't know and who is so stupid and dishonest not to admit that when it comes to primal goo and primal screams and primordial celebration firestorms, the reason I can scream like that and the reason my music so imprints on people is because I've got one hand in the gut pile and one hand in the Les Paul creation. And I'm sorry, you know, the band Indigenous came close, I suspect, but nobody in the history of music making since Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters and Lightnin' Hopkins, those original black gods of musical emotion and authority, they so lived with their spirit as one with the earth. They self-sustained themselves. They were the definition of rugged individual and independence. They lived off the grunt of the earth. And I'm the only guy that still does that. That's why that scream is so unprecedented. And believe me, I genuflected at the altar of Wilson Pickett and James Brown and even Steven Tyler. I mean, talk about scream gods. These guys are phenomenal screamers. But next, Uncle Ted, not even close.
Yeah. All the guys you've played with in your life, have you, or have been in your band, have you taken them all hunting?
No, I haven't really. The hunting urge, talking about primordial, talking about the primal scream, if you are gung-ho, and again, boy, does the term gung-ho describe all my bandmates or what? They're such gifted, work ethic-driven samurai seekers of excellence, that when you get into that, and especially if you weren't raised, you know, being taken fishing and hunting with your mom or dad, if you hadn't experienced that, in order to plunge 100% into the electronic delivery of your musical art, the pursuit of that art delivery, it literally continues to move you further away from that guttural gut pile. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you don't
you're interested in the city all the time in the city and traveling. So I've taken a bunch of them and even, you know, like Ricky Medlock, who has Native American blood coursing through his veins and is just a talent of the ultimate capability.
Jacksonville, Florida, where I was born.
Yes. And so he was a hunter and a fisher, but there's not many. Now, Sammy Hagar, who I just, you know, he's always been friends of mine, and his daughter, even being raised in the hippie epicenter of Mill Valley, California. She is a gung-ho pursuer of the great spirit of the wild, the outdoor lifestyle. And all of the people that I have taken, I took the damn Yankees out, and it's not comfortable if you're used to room service. you know what I mean? It's getting out there before the sun comes up, and it's nasty, or it's either cold or wet or super hot, or, you know, you're in the mountains and there's no Starbucks nearby. So if you pursued the cush of life, which I'm cushing right now. I'm laying on a beautiful bed on a beautiful ranch with the dogs at my feet. So I'm a big celebratory cush master, but I also like the Natty Bumppo, Crazy Horse, Cochise, Sitting Bull, you know, Jeremiah Johnson, Daniel Boone, Davy Crockett, connection with the earth as a hunter, a fisherman, a trapper, a farmer, a rancher. So I have taken a bunch of them. They all enjoy it. For example, Michael Lutz of Brownsville Station, the master of Smokey the Boys Room, is my musical Motown blood brother. He used to pheasant hunt and duck hunt, even though he's hardcore vegan, which gives me more ducks, by the way. he used to do that. But again, you move away from that. The more you're into the music, which again brings me back to my priorities, that in order to play the most powerful, and I know this is cocky of me to say this, but I really am good at cocky. I play the most forehead vein popping music in the world. Now I give a nod and a blood brother salute to James Brown, Wilson Pickett, Steven Tyler. I mean, just to sing Back in the Saddle again, you got to have some forehead veins popping during the entire song. And certainly Sammy Hagar gets those crescendos, and Wayne Cochran and Mitch Ryder. These guys are my heroes because they always crescendoed, and it was always manifested with veins popping off their forehead, which every one of my songs have. In fact, every one of my songs is a crescendo from beginning to end, almost. So that being said, it's the necessary and self-inflicted, what is perceived to be, discomfort of the hunting, outdoor, conservation lifestyle. You have to enjoy sitting in a tree and it's 20 below zero, and you got to be really in love with nature to participate even in the discomforting conditions. So a lot of the guys in the rock and roll world, we can get really spoiled with room service, you know what I mean, and people taking care of us. So that natural discomfort of exercising your reasoning predatorship in wild, you know, weather testing conditions, it's not for everybody, but it's really, really for me.
I heard that Joe Perry came to your place and you took him hunting and in the morning and fishing in the afternoon. Is that true?
Yes. It was Steven Tyler and Joe Perry came to my
farm
in Michigan. Yeah, they're both out there, and they did good, by the way. They were, you know, Steven grew up hunting and trapping. He was a trapper in Yonkers, New York. Steven is a real knowledgeable outdoorsman. It is proof because he always has some form of weaponry on his body. just as a pragmatic consideration of, you know, of utilitarian independence. But yes, it's both Steven and Joe. They were real naturally attentive and stealthy, not to be confused with Sebastian Bach, who I took out. For some reason, Sebastian hates me because I tried to help him get clean and sober.
Yeah,
so
he's
you either get
bad.
Clean and sober, or you hate the guy that tries to help you. So whatever.
Did you?
So Sebastian, when he came out and did a couple of episodes of his TV show, I don't know, MTV or whatever it was, he was really uncomfortable out there. I mean, and that's not a criticism. It's again, it's not for everybody. Some people are really good at knitting, and some people are really good at throwing hand grenades. And a lot of the times, the two shall not cross paths. So I admire those that can make that transition, and we call it the spirit of the wild. It really is the Native American Aboriginal connection with reverence to the source of all of our lives. And quite honestly, it is nature that is the source of all of our quality of life. You know, some people might not kill their own food, but they're paying somebody to kill it. Some people might not kill their own stage clothes, but they're paying somebody to do it. Somebody might not start their own generator for electricity, but they're paying somebody to displace wildlife so that they can have concrete and buildings and electricity. So this is the educational jihad that I've been on all my life, is that we are all consumers, and we need to be honest about the system by which we take from nature and probably be driven, as the Nugent family is, to put more back into nature. You will never do an interview with anybody in your life, Michael, who has planted more trees than I have, who has dedicated more dollars and elbow grease to cleaning and maximizing the health and just the health of rivers and streams and lakes and woods and fields. So this is my lifestyle, and because I murder innocent animals.
Well, even the hardcore vegans, I don't know if a lot of them realize it, but hardcore vegan diet, a lot of animals die to get vegan.
Well, yeah, but I still hold the world record podcast with Joe Rogan, and yeah. He's a bright guy.
I listen to it.
Yeah, well, I unleashed a fact that caused more furrowed brows, squinting eyes, and tilting of heads than any fact unleashing in the history of the world. And you're alluding to it, and that if you are a 100% gung-ho vegan, like my son Rocco is, he has a digestive condition, he can't eat dairy, he can't eat flesh, and there's some vegetation he can't eat. So he's very strict in his vegan diet. But in order to grow all that beanery for tofu, the farmer kills everything. Every squirrel, every snake, every turtle, every frog, every bird nest, every gopher, every rabbit, everything in that field for your next tofu salad. The farmer dismembers with his disc and his plow, and if any of those animals slither back in to the adjoining habitat, he comes in with Monsanto poison and kills everything so you can have a tofu salad. Anybody that doesn't know that is absolutely soulless, because it's inescapable science. So, sometimes if people, you know, when you take someone to rehab, you're doing it because you love them. But those who resist rehab, Amy, doper dip, if you resist rehab, you don't love your life as much as the people who are trying to help you love your life. So, perpetrator, therein of science and truth, logic, common sense, and reality. And if you adhere to it, it's not mine. It just is. 1 and 1 equals 2. That's not my idea. Wildlife needs habitat, which is where our quality air, soil, and water comes from. So if that wildlife is not valuable, i.e. hunting licenses, sporting goods, if you don't manage that ground for wildlife habitat, you are not creating clean air, soil, and water. So clean air, soil, and water, quality of life, comes because hunters, fishermen, and trappers paid gazillions of dollars so they can go hunting.
And, you know, they in California, I'm in San Francisco. I have a place up in the mountains, too, up in Trinity County. But I live in San Francisco. I'm in San Francisco right now. San Francisco, or California this year, just banned fur, hunting for fur.
I know it.
And they still kill those animals. They just throw them in a hole.
Michael, can you believe the cultural deprivation that so many in our society, they cling to it? You know, ignorance is understandable. I'm ignorant about how to tune a Cogsworth V8 engine in Indianapolis. I admit I'm ignorant. I wouldn't know how to tune that. So I'm not stupid enough to give direction to the masters who can tune that engine. But if I literally protect my ignorance because I'm uncomfortable with the information that I witness and I'm aware of, that's not ignorance, that's stupid. And you're dangerous when you're stupid, because you cling to your ignorance, and it creates more stupidity. And there you have that they ban trapping, but then the tax dollars go to pay USDA government trappers to kill the same animals, and instead of having this luxurious, beautiful fur that's as natural as can be, it's renewable. Instead of this natural, organic, renewable, unbelievable quality creation by God, instead of respecting it and giving it value, you pay a guy with wasted tax dollars, which California's got down to an art, and then you bury it in a hole in the ground. And you know that Indian on the hillside that's crying because a bunch of white dirt bags are polluting the rivers? That Indian is crying tears of blood because white men and idiot bureaucrats are pissing on magnificent creatures that we should revere. And when you ban hunting, fishing, or trapping, or compromise it in any way beyond sustained yield science, you are pissing on the animal's life. And that's why I've always done this, because I've witnessed this celebration of ignorance and disrespect for wildlife by not revering it as a valuable resource. And as a guy who eats venison and eats duck and pheasant and quail and woodcock and doves and squirrels and rabbits and antelope and cougars and bear meat, which is the ultimate diet, by the way, I'm balancing the land to make room for the inevitable reproduction of all that offspring every spring. And what am I creating? Quality air, soil, and water, and healthy, thriving wildlife. For people to hate me for doing that is the definition of cultural deprivation and denial. So I know I've always been on the right course, and if I ruffle feathers, cool. I'd rather just pluck them.
Yeah, you like that anyway. I have a question about bear. I have a place up in the mountains, and I put trail cams all up on the property. I've been hunting for about maybe 4 years, 4 or 5 years, and we have taken our Salukis out. We course them for jackrabbits for competition. We've been doing that for many years. But anyway,
it's exciting. Those are some happy dogs.
Oh,
huh?
Yeah, great dogs. And we let them. We put radio collars on them in the mountains, and you know they chase after rabbits and deer
sure.
and stuff.
That's exciting stuff.
Anyway, but there's, you know, I see bear on my trail cam, and it's against the law to bait in California, as you probably
know. Of course
know.
It is. And you can't use dogs either. Of course
yeah.
it is.
So I see, there's a 400-pound bear that goes in my trail cam. I only see it at night.
Oh, my God.
What tips would you give if I want to, because bear season opens the same time as deer season, how can I get that bear when it's only coming out at night and I can't bait it?
Well, in a state where they literally have cultivated the vulgarity of feces and needles and homelessness, it's hard to answer that question with any sense of decency or logic, but I will pursue that anyhow because I am the czar of decency.
Because I would imagine you would be able to get that bear.
Well, when you can't bait, because bears are so wary, they're just incredibly capable. You can't really use human terms. You can't say human terms. You can't say they're intelligent, but in the world of animals, they're supremely intelligent.
I heard they can smell 2 miles away.
They have the best sense of smell of any animal. Hogs and bears have you cannot beat their nose. You have to use the wind when you're hunting all wildlife, except turkeys. If a wild turkey, which, by the way, there's more wild turkeys in North America and California than ever in recorded history, thanks to the National Wild Turkey Federation and hunters' dollars. I thought I might mention that. But anyhow, if a turkey had the sense of smell of a deer, you'd never be able to kill them because they're omniscient. That being said, back to your bear. When you have corrupt bureaucracies like the California Fish and Wildlife and the jackbooted thugs of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, as directed by the Newsom goofball, who I guess likes when his fellow man lives in feces and needles. When you have evil punks like that running the state, the once beautiful state of California, you're going to have to improvise, adapt, and overcome. And you can kill that bear, and you should kill that bear. And the only way you can do it, because bears are irresponsibly under-harvested in California, there's so many of them, there is a reasonable chance of just ambushing them based on your trail camera information. I'm surprised they haven't banned that. And try to intercept that bear on his daily maneuvers seeking food because there's so much competition to the irresponsible overpopulation of bears in California and Colorado and elsewhere, because you're not allowed to use hounds or bait, you have to find the water source. That bear will visit water every day.
In the daytime, he will try, because there's a river right across the road from our mountain house. Would they go to the water in the daytime?
Absolutely, but when they're not pressured, in California, the bears are not pressured because you're not allowed to hunt them properly. They've banned the very methodologies that have proven to be beneficial to a healthy, balanced bear population. So you're going to have to find a water source. Then you can determine trails, especially as dry as it gets in California. Those bears will frequent that water source on a regular basis, including daytime. But you have to make sure you set up your ambush downwind of the trail. And that trail should be well-defined from the thickest, nastiest sanctuary zones of the property leading to that water source. And they, now, here's what I would do. Of course, you know, I'm a defiant son of a bitch. I would probably, you know, when I go into the wild, I like to take a little backpack of snacks with me. And sometimes I drop
some of that.
Stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm a sloppy eater. You know what
nothing,
I mean?
There's no law against accidentally spilling a donut on the trail.
I think if I was just hiking in bear country, not only would I carry my 10 millimeter, but I would probably continue my sloppy eating habits and probably drop an occasional slug of bologna and molasses covered bread.
Yeah. That's what I was talking to a guy who was hunting bear and he said there's no law against burning sugar in your backyard.
Aha. Well, actually there is, because if you killed that bear anywhere near an intentionally placed attractant, the jackbooted, irresponsible, oath-violating, anti-wildlife punks in that bureaucracy would still give you a ticket and probably nail you up against the wall. And I know there's great game wardens, there's great game departments out there, but where's your spine, man? Where's your sense of decency and respect for wildlife, where you actually enforce laws that are anti-nature, that make a bear a liability instead of an asset? Those game wardens should be ashamed of themselves, but so many of them have lost their souls, they don't have any shame. They probably drive drunk, and they probably shoot stop signs with their pistols.
You have turkey on your property?
Lots of turkey, but they're giving me the finger. I have not killed a turkey yet this year. Huh. In fact, it's funny because I hunt hard every day. And
in the springtime, you hunt. I get, because you hunt turkeys in the springtime.
Oh yeah, turkeys. Springtime turkey is one of the greatest thrills in the world. They're so alert. They see 360 degrees. They're very elusive.
I got a turkey with a bow, and with that, the only animal I've ever killed is a squirrel and a turkey, other than fish.
But I got a turkey with a bow. That's quite an accomplishment.
I think I got lucky. I chopped his neck off, but I think it was a lucky shot.
Well, that's good. I'll take luck any time, brother.
So you kill turkey with a bow?
Oh, yeah, many.
Huh.
Yeah, I've killed Osceolas in Florida with my bow and my Glock 10 millimeter. I've killed Easterns in Michigan with my Glock 10 millimeter shotgun and my bow and arrow. I've killed Rio Grandes in Texas with my bow and arrow and a rifle many years ago. And then I've killed Merriam's in South Dakota with my bow and arrow on a number of occasions. So I've killed the grand slam of American turkeys. I've never killed a Gould's or an oscillated down in Mexico, even though there are some Gould's down in Arizona. But I'm not a grand slam trophy kind of guy. To me, the trophy is the meat.
Yeah, I agree. I feel the same way. When Joe Perry and Steven Tyler were on your came hunting, did they hunt with a gun or a bow?
They hunted with the rifle.
Uh-huh.
It was on my Michigan farm, and they were doing a performance in, I think it was Pine Knob, many, many years ago, probably in the 90s, right? It might have been during or just before the damn Yankees period, or thereabouts. And they were very interested. In fact, both of them have quite the gun collection. They both have class 3 machine guns. Which I'm not so sure I want to be around Joe Perry with a machine gun. But being that as it may, and I love the guys. But yeah, they everybody's fascinated. They might, you know, claim that what I do is wrong, but they know deep in their heart that hunting is perfect. hunting is the ultimate conservation. If you want to be an environmentalist, the best first step is to get a hunting, fishing, and trapping license and bring balance to the great outdoors and the wildlife populations. So, and again, I revert back to the inevitable science of clean air, soil, and water production. It comes from wildlife habitat, and if you don't harvest the surplus every year in a responsible, sound science basic manner, that habitat will be decimated within a few short years. So they understood that, and they're good guys. And they came out. We had a great day. We had, I think, we had backstraps on the barbecue that day over Michigan oak coals. And so there's a real, you know, I use the term blood brother when people are really connected spiritually and intelligently and are there for each other. And those occasions, even though I felt that same connection just jamming with them on Milk Cow Blues or Drain Kept a Rolling, I got up on stage with them a number of times, there's a real musical blood brotherhood as well that goes back to a primordial scream. And but that day, I think they played with a little bit more piss and vinegar that night after having some Uncle Ted backstraps to fuel their spirit.
I saw you guys on stage together at Florida World Music Festival. What was it, 1978 or 79?
Oh, yeah.
And you were the last band that night. And I think you, my guys might have flip-flopped that entire tour. But that night, you were the last band. And they jumped on stage with you for O'Carroll. And
that's right. What a great song. I did that with the Charlie Daniels Band.
Oh, yeah,
too.
I saw that.
You
saw that on video.
What kind of guitar tone is that? Is that the greatest guitar tone in the world or what?
So back then you were using dual Showmans, and then you moved to Peavey's. What are you using now?
Well, I'm always experimenting. Right now in my living room, I got some magnetones, some brand new magnetones.
On stage, what are you using?
On stage, I use the magnetones, some old Fender Twins, and an old Custom, the KUSTOM. And I'll tell you, Michael, it's all about tone, because tone inspires your fingers to go places and your ears to manipulate those fingers based on the tone. And I was playing some licks this morning that I guarantee God has not authorized yet. This Gibson Birdland, I got a 64 Gibson Birdland that I have. I got four of them in the living room, and a Les Paul, and a PRS. But I played some licks this morning that it's like I'm compelled to stop and check out what I did, but as you're doing it, you can't stop. So I still love it. I'll be 72 this year. Can you believe? Do I sound like I'm 72?
No.
I'll be 72 this year, but the most important thing I can say on your podcast is that's 72 years clean and sober, which means all my shit is working really good. And it, including my passion for the music and my passion for musical adventure. And so my amplifiers, I'm constantly dicking around with them. And my God, 2019, not only the greatest, tightest, most fun tour of my life, but the 2019 with Greg Smith on bass and Jason Heartless on drums. Dear God, am I a lucky son of a bitch or what? It was not only the greatest, tightest, most ferocious, fun tour of my life, but the reason it was the greatest, tightest, most ferocious, fun tour of my life is because my guitar tone has never been more insane. And Michael, you watch Axis TV this Sunday, May 3rd.
I have it DVR'd already.
Telling you, when I whip out that Birdland with Sammy and Vic, who I revere, I adore these guys as
great
musical gods, and I start slamming the opening to Jenny Take a Ride by Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels, Sammy and Vic both look, you watch the look on their face. Afterwards, I wish they would have kept this filming. They went, Ted, Vic and I were looking around. Where's the drums?
Yeah.
I hear drums.
Yeah, talk about.
I heard a drummer.
That's your right hand.
That's my right hand, the way I pound those strings. I play all six strings. I mean, you got six strings, use them. And the way I flail. If with their, like a gonzo bo diddly, that's how the intro Stranglehold is so compelling. All those grace notes and counter rhythms. There's like a tambourine, maracas, hi-hat, snare, bass drum, and hula girls all going on at the same time on the intro of Stranglehold. It's constant flailing in just a sexual goo of rhythm. And when I on Access TV with Sammy and Vic, you got to turn up the TV volume. You won't believe, you swear to God, there was a drummer in the room because of my the way I mute the strings slightly with my right hand over that Gibson Birdland Tutomatic bridge. You get all those you swear to God there were five naked girls with tambourines and maracas and somebody's beating the living hell out of the drums, and it's all about my craving for those original Bo Diddley, Chuck Berry, Little Richard, Mitch Ryder, the Detroit Wheel, and James Brown rhythm hammer gods. And you're really going to... Sammy keeps calling. He says it's the best rock and roll road trips he's ever done. He said the entire crew and the entire team, the production team, was just... They've never stopped talking about it because I almost blew up my $100,000 Bronco just to show them a good time. But if you watch it... I know there's some great, great Sammy Hagar rock and roll road trips. But you know what I think, Michael? I think I agree with Sammy. This is the best one ever. You're going to have a riot. You're going to love this.
So did you guys play more than one song when you jammed?
Well, we were dicking around. I kind of showed them my style on the opening of Stranglehold. And we alluded to some other. But, you know, the bureaucracy of and the legality of authorizing certain pieces of music on television. You know, you see right. Some of these so-called documentaries, you know, about certain artists, and they're not even allowed to use the artist's music.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, what? You can't do a documentary on the Kinks without playing Kinks music, you dirtbag.
So those the old songs. You don't own the rights to those songs still?
Well, like David Bowie and many artists, and Michael Jackson and the Beatles. I sold the rights, the publishing rights to my music a number of years ago, based on future expectations, and it's a huge sum of money.
Yeah.
And I love huge sums of
money.
Right. if I'm gonna have money, I like them in huge sums. Anyhow, but we do have the rights. Doug Banker, the greatest manager in the world, he made sure that I can use my original music in my hunting shows and hunting presentations.
On Spirit of the Wild, yeah.
On Spirit of the Wild TV and any hunting-type outdoor conservation entity that I do. Like if I, on Shemaine and I do a podcast. I don't even know if we use my music, but we damn well ought to.
I've heard you play Stranglehold on when you came on with Shemaine. I think you played Stranglehold with Shemaine.
Yes, yes. I mean, what a lick. I mean, is there... I mean, you and I love music. I mean, real music lovers love every AC/DC guitar opening, and we love Walk This Way, and we love Paperback Writer and Ticket to Ride, and we love Satisfaction and Honky Tonk Women. We love all these killer guitar licks. But come on, Michael. Come on.
Oh, Stranglehold's one of the all-time sexy
guitar... No, it's not one of the all-time. It's the number one ever.
You know... I'm in a few bands, and a couple of the bands play Stranglehold. And there will be people in the audience that hate Ted Nugent, or they say they hate Ted Nugent. I mean, girls and guys, oh, Ted Nugent, blah, blah, blah. Then those same people, you'll play Stranglehold or Free For All, and they're dancing.
Yep. Yeah, well, I'm a delivery entity. I deliver my musical love, my cravings for what Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley and Little Richard and Jerry Lee Lewis invented. What those guys invented, I was there when they invented it. I was a mushy brain child, you know, absorbing all the information that God would bless me with, good, bad, and ugly. And when they invented this new cranking, authoritative, sensual stimuli soundtrack, unprecedented, heretofore never even attempted since you know the aborigines of prehistory beat on a stretched skin and twanged the bow to kill the enemy and kill dinner. It's so powerful, and I guarantee, Michael, all your favorite music came directly from the bowels of Chuck Berry, Bo Diddley, and Little Richard, and certainly Jerry Lee Lewis. It is so pummeling. It is so sexual. It is so primordial that is still the power drive behind everything Dave Grohl does and Greta Van Fleet and any other music that you love. AC/DC. I mean, I name all your favorite songs, all your favorite bands, all your favorite musicians, all your favorite musical moments, and it came from Chuck and Bo.
Yeah, well, listen to Live It Up. That's Bo Diddley right there.
Sure, sure.
You, those Birdlands, are they all stock, or do you modify them at all?
Well, they're all stock, but the only modification is I have to anchor the bridge, the Tune-O-Matic bridge. I have to anchor it to the body because it's free-floating.
Goes
and once my guitar gurus, Todd Carlson and my other Todd Baker, they intonate them to perfection. And I used to do it all by myself years ago, and I still do. I just bought a pristine 1965 Gibson Birdland natural blonde finish. Uh-huh. Oh, my God, Michael, I sleep with it. And this young man from North Dakota bought it from the original owner from 1965, and it wanted to come home to Uncle Ted.
Yeah.
I bought it from him, and I haven't anchored that bridge, but that's the only modification. Now, Blackie, the mighty Blackie that you see on Double Live Gonzo, because I sweat, because my crescendoing forehead vein popping 2-hour concerts create such a tsunami of sweat that I have destroyed some precious humbuckers, some PAF humbucker Gibson pickups
rust
over the years. They just rot out from my sweat. So I have replaced some of the humbuckers with burst buckers in some of my instruments. The Great White Buffalo, White Birdland, I had to replace those pickups. And Blackie, I had to replace those. But again, you know what? There was a time during the 70s and 80s where Gibson really lost control of their quality control, and some of those pickups weren't up to par.
Yeah.
But you know, and what every musician who's honest enough to, you know, admit that my politics are simply Constitution, Bill of Rights, we the people. That's my politics. If you have a problem with Ted Nugent's politics, I guess you hate America. That's really what it comes down to.
Sure.
But if they would shut up for 2 minutes and behind closed doors, and you ask my good friend Tom Morello, he's kind of a lefty guy, but he's a dear friend of mine, and we communicate. And if you got someone to take some truth serum, somebody who goes, I hate Nugent, he's a coward because he murders innocent animals that can't shoot back. What does that mean? What is that? Anyhow, if you could give them some truth serum, they would admit that it's in my hands. I have a style unlike anybody in the history of the world. From the muted counter rhythms and the grace notes of the intros to all my songs, especially on The Music Made Me Do It, those licks are classic. They're as good as anything that's ever happened in the history of noise. But I'm not given credit for that because people, I don't know, murder innocent animals. And a lot of the time, like, I'm not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame because all of those guys are on dope, and I hate dope.
It's ridiculous.
I hate dope. So anyhow, if you listen to my style, it doesn't have to be a 1964 100% stock Birdland. I can pick up pretty much any guitar, and it'll sound just like Ted Nugent, but there is some subtlety intonations and sonic minutia that happens when I have my old Birdlands through the proper amplification, the Magnatones, the Fenders, the Customs, and the Peavies. The Peavies were awesome. I still use some of those. That there's a certain touch in my hands that I make it sound that way. In fact, on Rock and Roll Road Trips, I think Sammy admits that when he picks up a Birdland, he sounds terrible because you have to hug it. You have to own the instrument because it's so prone to screaming feedback uncontrollably that it will interfere with the notes you hope to play. So there's a certain touch I discovered when I started playing it in 1965. And I just love the instrument to death, man.
I don't know if you know, but Henry Rollins gives you a lot of credit. Do you know Henry Rollins at all?
I do. I've seen him speak. But again, sometimes he knows that he's a big fan of, you know, you can call it punk rock or defiant rock or rebel rock. But he's a big fan of that primal urgency.
And he credits you, he and Ian MacKay, they had you know, they were into straight edge and all anti-drug. They credit you with them not ever drinking or doing drugs because they went to go see Ted Nugent, and they always heard Ted Nugent didn't smoke or drink. So they said, well, if Ted doesn't do it, I'm not going to do it either.
Yeah, I have seen that, and it makes me very happy. But you know what? And God bless Henry and those people that have acknowledged that. And there's a lot of musicians out there that have become clean and sober because of my relentless hammering against the suicide of substance abuse. But if you go to my Facebook, Michael, and you should, what a talking about truth, logic, common sense, goodwill, decency, piss and vinegar, defiance, rebel ferocity. My Facebook is like the ultimate shit kicker campfire. But if you go to my Facebook on any minute of any day and listen to the unsolicited testimonials to that degree, that these young people made the decision to never abuse their sacred temple with poisons or drugs or alcohol or tobacco because of an interview they saw me do or because of my rants on stage. You have no idea how proud I am of that.
I could talk to you for about 8 hours, but can I go about 15 more minutes with you? Do you mind?
Yeah, go nuts. I got a live Skype thing to do here at 11. That's 20 minutes from now.
Okay. The Cal Jam 2.
What a riot!
World famous story about you being in Africa the day before, and you got there 15 minutes before you're supposed to go on stage. Is that true?
That's absolutely true. I mean, I could keep you on the phone for 8 hours or 12 just telling you how I barely got out of the Sudan when the rebels started killing everybody. It was March of 1978. I was in the Sudan on safari, and I was on a tent camp foot safari like Teddy Roosevelt did in 1911. And we had Maasai and Watusis, dozens of them, that we relocate our camp based on the species of animals that we wanted to hunt. And I had a great time, but the monsoons came early and flooded out our camps. The Unimog, this really beastly four-wheel drive vehicle, would not get out of the river bottom where the floods came and washed us out. And then word came that at Khartoum Airport, the rebels had killed everybody and blown up the airport, and they're looking for white people to kill.
Huh.
Well, the Maasai led me through the jungles to Juba, and we went on foot, Michael. Go to a map and look the distance between Juba, Sudan, and Kapweta, Sudan. I was 30 years old, I guess. No, I wasn't either. 78? Yeah, I guess 30, huh? And I was like Sugar Ray Leonard on steroids. I was like Bruce Lee. I was so athletic.
Were you scared at all?
I was concerned, but I had a rifle and a few rounds of ammo left. In fact, I single-handedly fed the team as we escaped the rebels. At some point, it was either the Watusi handed me off to the Maasai or the Maasai handed me off to the Watusi. But they loved me because I was killing big game with a bow and arrow, and they were fascinated by that. I was shooting vultures out of the air with a bow and arrow. They were going to make me king of the tribe. It was awesome.
Did you have a road manager or anything with you?
No, I was there all by myself.
Huh. Wow.
And we made it to Kapweta, and these guys were scared for me because they knew that if the rebels, because the rebels were all on that drug, Contra, whatever it is, that makes you all zombie-like, like all drugs do. And they would just shoot everything. They shot entire herds of elephant. They killed everything with their AK-47s provided by the communists, you know, the same communists that are destroying our antibiotics and our medicines today. Anyhow, so long story short.
Chinese, go ahead.
Yeah, all communists. They're punks. They're devils. Anyhow, I saw a Red Cross plane doing a 180 on a makeshift runway, and I ran towards it. And he tried to go around me, but you can't get around me. I was Bruce Lee at that age. And I opened that door. It was a Super Cub, only held two people, single engine. And I said, get me out of here. He goes, you cannot come on this plane. I went, yeah, try to get me off, pal. Take off. Let's go.
Did you drop all your stuff? And
I only had a little brown shoulder bag with my toilet kit, a toothbrush and a hairbrush and some medicines, and clean underpants and socks. I only had one clean underpants and socks left. And I had my lion claws and teeth. I had a couple of warthog tusks and some fighting razor-sharp bracelet jewelry from the native people that they gave me. I gave them some arrows, and they gave me some razor-sharp fighting jewelry. So anyhow, I'm on this plane, and I, like I said, I could keep here for 100 days with the stories, but I forced that guy. I scared him. Talking about forehead vein popping, I said, "Fly me someplace! Get me out of here!" And we took off, and he took me to out of Sudan up to, boy, I'm gonna struggle to remember the names of the places where I went, to a major airport somewhere in North Africa, and I saw a plane going to Heathrow. Well, now, Michael, I'm covered in, I hadn't seen a bed or a shower in 10 days. I mean, I'm a dangerous looking guy. My hair's down to the middle of my back. I weigh 180 pounds of sheer muscle and sinew. And I got this little shoulder bag and a small jacket with blood and mud and caked stuff on my boots and my clothing. And I'm just filthy. And I didn't even have time to go to the bathroom in this airport. And I saw a plane going to Heathrow in London. So I ran to the gate, American Express card, and I got a seat on it. And I don't even know what day it is. I know that I have a concert on March 18th. I'm going on stage right around 5 o'clock. I don't know what day it is. Now I'm discovering that I can't remember exactly if heading back to America would be would save me hours or it would cost me hours. I think it would save me hours. But anyhow, so now I get to Heathrow and I see the Concorde, the supersonic Concorde at gate such and such, and people are looking at me because I'm a filthy wreck. And I figured out how to use a phone in that Heathrow airport, and I called my management and I said, "I'm on such and such Concorde to Kennedy Airport in New York. Set it up." And I hung up the phone.
Huh.
I didn't have time. I don't want anybody going, "Oh, well, you're going where? Who is this?" And I'm like, shut up. Just listen to my directions to do something, would you? So I run to the Concorde in Heathrow, and now the security is chasing me because I look dangerous. The Concorde gate is closing. I run past the gate security, and I get in the Concorde. I sit down and I strap on the seatbelt. And the security comes in, and I'm holding up my American Express card. I go, "You know, you can wrestle to get me off of here. You can just take my money. Take me to Kennedy Airport."
So they took your money.
And they were ready to wrestle with me, and the one security guard went, "Oh, it's loud, man. It's the most mad man." I said, "That's right. I am the Motor City Madman. You don't want to fuck with me. Just take my goddamn card and let's get going here." Well, they turned pleasant quickly. They took my card. They bought me they sold me the ticket. I think it was $3,000. And I'm on my way now. So I go in this tiny little, broom closet-sized bathroom, and I try to, clean my armpits and wash my balls a little bit and clean up, brush my teeth, try to get some water through my crusty, mud-encrusted, lion's mane hair, and at least get some of the crust off me. Well, we landed at Kennedy, and they did arrange for a police car to meet me and take me to a TWA heading for LAX. They actually held it up for a half an hour. And I got on. We landed at LAX. They had a helicopter waiting for me on the tarmac. They put me on the helicopter. I landed backstage at the California Jam at the Ontario Speedway 15 minutes before I was supposed
so
to hit
you
the
did
stage.
Not take a shower when you were on stage.
Nope.
You had not showered.
I had not showered in 11 days.
You showered after you got off stage, then, I'm assuming.
I showered after I got off stage. So if you want to talk about a guy, performing you know, not just figuratively with the primal goo running through his system. I literally had the primal goo all over me. But you watch, the wind was blowing that air in my face the whole time. Uh-huh. And here's the exciting part. So as I'm getting ready to go on stage, my manager comes up and goes, you know, I don't want to mess up your gig, Ted, but this is the band's last show.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that.
They're quitting after the show, and I went, whatever, let's get out there and rock our balls off.
So you did not know that Rob Grange and Derek were going to leave it. That was that.
I did not know that. So crazy. And they did great. They played great, but they were reticent. They didn't unleash. And I, you know, I've always revered Rob's incredible bass.
Fantastic bass player. Fantastic.
I've always raved about Rob.
Hibernation. Come on, man. Hibernation.
Come on. And Derek St. Holmes, one of the most gifted, talented, soulful guitar players, vocalist in the history of the world. Of course, the late, great Cliff Davies, one of the greatest drummers that ever walked the earth. So I celebrate that. I have no ill will. But here's the thing. They quit because they claimed I was holding them back. Well, if you get away from that is holding you back, wouldn't you go forward? I love the guys, but they didn't go forward.
Yeah, they did Saint Paradise, and it didn't do much. But
it did nothing. And I love Derek; he's my brother, and Rob. But how does a guy that is one of the greatest bass players that ever lived? How do you quit? How do you stop playing bass? I don't get it. So I love the guys. I thank them from the bottom of my heart, and I do it in every interview, for putting their heart and soul into my musical dream. It to this day, from the Royal High Boys in 1958 to Greg and Jason in 2020, I'm living my musical dream. And Rob and Derek and Cliff and all those bandmates, they were all full on heart and soul. I'm hearing today some live recordings of the Ted Nugent and the Amboy Dukes from 69, 70, 71 with KJ Knight on drums and Rob Ruzga on bass and then Rob Grange on bass. My God, the music we made back then right up to today in 2020. Michael, are you kidding me? Some of the best music in the history of sound.
All right, I got to put this out to the universe because I will not forgive myself. At least I say this in front of you. My dream of all dreams is to spend the day hunting with Ted Nugent, bow hunting with Ted Nugent, and then in the afternoon go into your practice space and jam a lot of Nugent tunes with you. So I'm just putting that out there right now for the universe.
Wouldn't that be the ultimate day?
I know how to play every classic Nugent song. I learned how to play bass
good
from
for you. Well, I'll tell you, Michael, I'll put it right here. I'm a gregarious, open guy. I have a heart of gold. I wouldn't deny that. Let's try to make that happen at some time. Maybe you come out here to a Spirit Wild Ranch or maybe the swamps of Michigan, and I do that. You know, I put on a pork jam in Michigan where these guys come out and hunt wild boar with me. And then we get in a studio and I show them the Nugent musical techniques and we do jam. So maybe we can make that happen. So let Linda know that that's your dream. And Linda knows that if we can facilitate it, we shall.
You had me backstage after the show in San Francisco. And I told you, I said, you know, your bass player is great, but if anything ever happens to him, would you please call me? And you said, why do I have a feeling that my bass player is in danger?
Well, my bass, I mean, Greg Smith.
He's fantastic. He's a great bass player.
No, I mean, all my bass players are you. And not only that, but let's make a note as a bass playing aficionado. You know that unprecedented, earth-shattering bass part on Stranglehold?
Of course. I watched Rob Grange gave a tutorial on how to play it, and I studied it.
Well, guess what? On the record, guess who played it?
Oh, you did?
I did.
Huh. So I wonder
That's me on the record.
So I wonder if he's giving the lesson exactly how you played it.
Rob could do it. Rob played the Stranglehold bass line. I wrote the song on bass. It's a Fender P bass through a Fender amp.
He played jazz. And, he played a P bass. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. He played them both. He played an Olympic, and I played a Olympic bass on Dog Eat Dog. I played a Fender bass six on Little Miss Dangerous, and Thunder Thighs.
And also on the new album, I think you played a Fender bass.
On Sunrise. How, as a bass player, how about that Fender bass six on Sunrise? Yes. Is that the most unique sound you've ever heard?
That's great.
But anyhow, Rob played bass on Stranglehold, but he played a super low end single string grind on the low E string on the fifth fret. He played a bottom end, so I could unleash that because you hear all those counter rolling rhythms that I play, Michael. I'm sorry, nobody else on planet Earth, and I'm not bragging.
You don't have to talk. You're talking to the converted man.
Well, you know, I think just last month, I think on Facebook Live, I showed how I played that bass on a Barry Sparks custom bass.
Well, I got to look for that.
Yeah, look for that because it's the subtleties of my rolling open A string multi rhythms. It's so defined, and it parallels the rolling staccato of the guitar.
So you played the solo as well.
No, that's Rob's solo.
Okay, okay.
Rob came up. I said I want an F sharp solo. Which, by the way, Michael, everybody went, bass solos aren't cool. We shouldn't do a bass solo. And I went, shut up. We're doing a bass solo. Rob, you're going to do one because he's the master. Of melodic movements. You listen to what he did at the end of Great White Buffalo in 1971.
Yes, exactly, yes.
Listen to what he did on Hibernation. Are you kidding me? Rob Graves is the greatest that ever lived.
The beginning of Hibernation is like a bass clinic.
Absolutely.
Entire Tooth, Fang, and Claw album is like a bass clinic.
It's a monster. And you listen to that bass solo in Stranglehold, that is a moment of genius
bass work.
And that's Rob Grange all the way.
All right, Ted Nugent, thank you so much for doing this. Would you please do an ID for the Rock and Roll Geek Show?
I can do that.
Go ahead.
Well, let's see. You want a Rock and Roll Geek Show, right?
Yeah.
All right, you ready? This is it.
Yeah,
well,
go ahead.
God bless... God bless America. My name is Ted Nugent, full-time, and I am the Rock and Roll Geek, and I'm proud to share the Sonic Bombast with my Sonic Bombast blood brother, Michael Butler, on the Rock and Roll Geek Show. Live it up, Michael!
All right, thank you so much, Uncle Ted. I really appreciate it. It was an honor
to talk
to you.
Well, thanks for supporting my you know, I love my music, and I love people that love my music, and that's why last year's tour was so powerful, Michael. Only real music lovers show up to my concerts.
I wanted to talk to you about this coronavirus shit, but we don't have time. But you going to still do meet and greets?
You know, everything is up in the air right now. I hope to hell that Jason and Greg and I can unleash the greatest, you know, American Dream soundtrack of all times this summer. A lot of our gigs in July and August are already sold out. Yeah. I hope the tour happens, and if the tour happens, I'm going to do meet and greets. You're damn well.
Good. All right, Ted, thank you so much for doing this. Enjoy the rest of your day. I really appreciate it.
All right, Michael, live it up. Godspeed.
Bye. There you go. Uncle Ted, I could have talked to him for fucking hours, man. All right, let's close out with a song. I'm going to stop this, and I'll come back and say some parting words, and then we'll close out with the song. All right, thank you, friends. All right, friends, I'm going to close out with a song from Survival of the Fittest. What I was talking about at the beginning of Ted Nugent's interview, I said, I go way back to Papa's Will. So I'm going to play Papa's Will for you, live Survival of the Fittest. Before I do that, thank you so much, everybody who supports a Rock and Roll Geek Show. This is a value for value, as Adam Curry says. If you get any value out of this show, any at all, I just ask that you can please help the show out by support, by donating whatever you think the show is worth to you. Without your donations, as you know, this show cannot continue. It would die horrible, putrid, stench-filled, getting eaten by a 400-pound black bear in your backyard up in the mountain house. Kind of death. All right, friends, here's Papa's Will. If you enjoyed this, go to Ted Nugent's Facebook and send him, or even his website, and send his management an email and just say, I heard you on the Rock and Roll Geek Show and thank you for doing that. That way he will not think he wasted an hour of his life doing this crappy podcast. All right, friends, here is Papa's Will. Thank you so much for listening. I will talk to you very soon. Be safe. Life is good, friends.
Papa's will.
It's a rock and roll geek train wreck.